Welcome to the debate. Today we are digging into a highly provocative piece of analysis. It's John McMurtry's 2003 essay, Understanding the U.S. War State. Our discussion is really going to center on his rigorous examination of the historical, the psychological, and, well, the material drivers behind the 2003 United States invasion of Iraq.
Yeah, and the central question we're exploring today is this. Does the invasion of Iraq represent the manifestation of a uniquely American ruling group mind and a fundamentally entrenched war state?
Right. Or?
Or is this psychological framework just too deterministic? You know, does it fail to capture the calculated real politic and the really significant global resistance that McMurtry actually documents in his own analysis?
Exactly. So, I will argue that McMurtry successfully proves the United States operates as an entrenched war state governed by an almost religious group mind that historically justifies aggressive expansion through projection and false pretexts.
And I will argue that while the material facts of resource acquisition and international law violations detailed in this material are frankly undeniable, the evidence of massive global pushback contradicts the idea of an inescapable monolithic group mind. To me, the evidence points instead to a cold, calculated, and ruthless imperial strategy executed by very specific actors.
To begin laying out my position, we really have to look closely at the core thesis here. McMurtry argues that the U.S. operates on a continuous historical tradition of using false pretexts to wage aggressive wars, primarily for resource control. But what makes this analysis so distinct is his assertion that the state functions under a ruling group mind.
Mm-hmm.
This isn't just a metaphor for patriotism. He describes it as a primitive, quasi-religious fundamentalism. This mindset equates the security state with absolute moral right, and it actively projects its own aggression onto its enemies. It demands absolute obedience to the idea that the nation's military apparatus is synonymous with freedom itself.
It is a fascinating psychological framework, absolutely.
And I believe it's entirely necessary to explain the massive complicity we saw leading up to the 2003 invasion. I mean, if we don't look at this through the lens of a psychological group mind, how else do we explain the media transforming a war of aggression into an entertainment spectacle? How else do we explain the political class completely abdicating their responsibilities?
Or the United Nations Security Council's ceremony of avoidance, where blatant violations of international law were just met with a sleepwalk of official euphemisms.
Only a pervasive, paralyzing group mind can account for that level of institutional cognitive dissonance.
I certainly acknowledge the incredibly robust documentation of atrocities and the blatant double standards of international law presented here. The resource motives, specifically the pursuit of oil and the economic threat of Iraq's conversion of oil revenues to euros, are undeniable. However, I challenge the group mind and paranoid mass cult framework as overly deterministic.
In what sense?
Attributing these catastrophic events to an unconscious moral syntax or a cultural delusion, I think it severely underestimates the cold, calculated economic and strategic interest at play here. We are pointed directly to the project for the new American century. This was the blueprint drafted in September 2001 by Dick Cheney, Donald Rumsfeld, and Paul Wolfowitz.
Right.
We also see references to a report from the Washington Center for Strategic and International Studies, which explicitly states that oil is no longer just a commodity, but a determinant of national security and international power.
Those are certainly key documents, but they exist within a broader cultural context.
But these aren't the unconscious reflexes of a religious cult. They are the deliberate machinations of a corporate war party. Furthermore, I really want to emphasize the data on global resistance. Over 30 million citizens demonstrated worldwide in a single weekend. The UN Security Council overwhelmingly rejected the motion for war. This proves that the group mind is not a universally imprisoning force, but rather a narrative aggressively pushed and often successfully resisted by specific actors.
I see why you think that, but let me give you a different perspective on how we interpret that historical and strategic continuity. If we look at the historical timeline provided, it becomes evident that the 2003 invasion is not an anomaly, born of a specific administration strategy. It is the defining political tradition of the state.
You're referring to the 19th century annexations?
Exactly. There is a direct line drawn from the displacement and destruction of 25 million First Peoples to the 1845 seizure of Mexican territories, which, you know, included Texas, Nevada, New Mexico, and California. In that instance, General Zachary Taylor unilaterally invaded under the false pretext of avenging American blood.
And the detail about Abraham Lincoln there is remarkable.
Right. Abraham Lincoln, then a young congressman, actually exposed that this pretext of American blood was tied to an Anglo-British business strategy to impose free trade. He blew the whistle on it. And then we see the exact same pattern repeat in 1898 with the Spanish-American War. That was triggered by the internal explosion of the USS Maine, which was immediately used as a false pretext to seize the Philippines, Guam, and Puerto Rico.
That's where the famous quote from media baron Randolph Hearst comes in.
"You furnish the pictures, I'll furnish the war." The comparison drawn between Hearst's media drumbeat and the media drumbeat for Iraq in 2003 is impossible to ignore. This proves a permanent structural formula. The state routinely uses false pretexts, whether it's avenging blood, the USS Maine, or non-existent weapons of mass destruction, to mask aggressive expansion. It's a deeply entrenched psychological and structural pattern, not just the invention of the 2001 Project for the New American Century.
I come at it from a different way. While that history of expansion and the repeated use of false pretexts is entirely factual and powerfully laid out, framing it as an inevitable psychological condition or an ordinance of destiny is highly problematic.
Why problematic? If the pattern holds for over a century and a half, why not call it structural?
Because it risks absolving the specific contemporary actors who actively and consciously dismantled international law. This wasn't an abstract historical ghost forcing their hands. The analysis explicitly names the Bush Jr. administration and identifies the blueprint of Cheney, Rumsfeld, and Wolfowitz. No rogue state in modern history has remotely matched that specific administration's continuous and systematic violation of international law.
But they couldn't have achieved that without a populace and an institutional framework primed to accept it.
True, but look at how they operated. They explicitly threatened the UN, declaring they would go it alone. They effectively told the Security Council that it either agreed to a US-led invasion or it was irrelevant. That is not an abstract historical tradition acting out. That is a specific group of individuals executing a highly articulated plan to shape the international security order in line with their specific material interests. If we reduce their calculated actions to a symptom of American cultural delusion, we lose sight of the active, aggressive agency required to forcibly usurp the UN inspection process and launch a war of aggression.
But we cannot ignore how effectively that agency was shielded by the broader cultural psychology. I mean, to understand the efficacy of the ruling group mind, we really have to break down the five principles of the new fundamentalism that McMurtry details.
Let's unpack those, because they are central to your reading of this.
They are. The first principle is the preconscious equation of the national security state with America itself. The second assumes America is the ultimate source of freedom, God's material embodiment on earth. The third posits that America is always and necessarily right in all conflicts.
Which effectively outlaws domestic dissent.
Exactly. If the military is freedom, criticizing the military means you are anti-freedom. And that bleeds right into the fourth and fifth principles, which dictate that any force opposing the U.S. is inherently evil and must be attacked preemptively. This framework actively paralyzes critical thought. Look at the media's complicity. The coverage treated the war as an ideal mass-market site for entertainment of lawless power. It was packaged with graphics and theme music.
It was certainly a sanitized, broadcast-friendly version of a military invasion.
And it extended to the highest diplomatic levels. Look at the United Nations capitulation. There is a deeply disturbing observation of the Security Council meeting on March 19th, right after military inspections were forcibly terminated. The council members were enthralled to what is described as a ceremony of avoidance.
They praised the inspectors but wouldn't condemn the invasion.
Right. They expressed angst over the impending humanitarian catastrophe, but no one mentioned that the massive military invasion was the supreme international crime under the Nuremberg Charter. The U.S. bypassed the Nuremberg Principles, specifically Principles 1, 2, and 6A regarding crimes against peace. They ignored Article 54 of the Geneva Convention, which explicitly protects objects indispensable to civilian survival, like drinking water installations. Yet the diplomatic community completely ignored the illegality of the invasion in that room. This demonstrates that the group mind operates as an invisible prison, instituting severe self-censorship where even the hardest facts disappear if they challenge the state's moral superiority.
I'm sorry, but I just don't buy that. Let me tell you why. The analysis contains deep contradictions regarding this idea of absolute control and an invisible prison of the mind. You mentioned the capitulation of the institutions, but the data points to an unprecedented failure of this supposed group mind to manufacture consent globally.
A failure? The invasion happened. The consent was manufactured where it mattered.
But not globally and not easily. It explicitly notes that 96% of the people in Turkey were against the invasion, even as their government considered large financial bribes to allow staging areas. Over 90% of the people in Spain opposed the war, directly defying their prime minister, who was aggressively advocating for it alongside the US and Britain. And we cannot ignore the 30 million citizens across the world who demonstrated against the invasion in a single weekend.
But those millions of people marching didn't stop the war machine.
No, but they prove the mind wasn't imprisoned. Furthermore, despite the diplomatic cowardice you rightly point out on March 19th, the Security Council ultimately repudiated the U.S.-led war by an overwhelming rejection of any motion for it. There were, to the Council's credit, few takers of the blood money. If the moral syntax of this group mind truly imprisoned global culture, if it were as inescapable as the psychological framing suggests, this massive historic pushback simply wouldn't exist. The narrative of an invincible delusion actually obscures the reality that the war party had to bypass the democratic will of the global public precisely because they could not convince them.
It is true that there was massive resistance. I won't deny that the global public saw through much of the rhetoric. But the administration bypassed that resistance precisely by relying on the psychological tactic of projection, which is central to how the group mind sustains itself domestically.
How so?
There is a unifying underlying principle at work here. State justifications always project onto the designated enemy exactly what the security state is planning or doing itself. We see this brilliantly exposed in the sheer hypocrisy of demanding Iraqi compliance with UN resolutions.
Ah, the double standard with Israel.
Yes. Iraq was accused of violating 12 to 18 resolutions prior to the inspections. Meanwhile, the U.S. military partner, Israel, had violated 64 UN resolutions with total impunity, engaging in land seizures, collective punishments, and assassinations. The U.S. demanded strict adherence to international law from one nation while actively shielding another from those exact same laws.
It is a glaring inconsistency.
But the projection becomes even more glaring when we look at the weapons of mass destruction. We are reminded that Iraq's WMDs were originally sold to Saddam Hussein at great profit by the US, Britain, and other Security Council members.
The original UN report documented all of that.
And what happened to it? Bush officials actually took the original Iraq report to the UN and deleted all the pages documenting those military sales before distributing it. Secretary Rumsfeld completely refused to work with Senate committees to expose continued military sales by armament manufacturers. So we have to ask, is this just a deliberate cynical strategy, or is it a structure of paranoid delusion? Given how perfectly the state accuses others of its own crimes to justify preemptive strikes, accusing Iraq of ignoring international law while explicitly planning to invade regardless of what the UN decides, it points to a profound psychological delusion that sustains a blatant double standard. The group mind cannot compute what does not fit its fixed presuppositions. The contradiction is never reconciled because the mind simply rejects it.
That's a compelling argument, but have you considered that this projection and hypocrisy are not symptoms of a delusion, but rather the necessary rhetorical cover for a highly rational, fundamentally material objective?
You think that delusion is entirely manufactured? Just a cynical cover story?
I agree entirely on the sheer hypocrisy and the factual double standards laid out here.
The deletion of the UN report pages, the shielding of Israel, it's all meticulously documented. But I interpret the motive differently. We are pointed directly to the material evidence, namely the targeted destruction of Iraq's civil commons.
And we should define what is meant by the civil commons here, because it's a vital concept.
It is. The civil commons refers to the social infrastructure built upon publicly owned resources. Since the 1950s, Iraq's publicly owned oil reserves financed the most advanced social infrastructure in the Arab world. We are talking about free education and universal health care. Even under brutal sanctions, their publicly run food distribution system was described by the UN World Food Program as the most efficient in the world.
So the argument is that this system itself was the target.
Precisely. The greatest enemy to an expanding empire isn't a dictator. It is a civil commons of publicly owned resources which obstructs corporate market control. The regime change was never fundamentally about Saddam Hussein or WMDs. It was about the forced takeover of the greatest and most accessible high-quality oil reserves on the planet.
Which ties into the shift away from the US dollar.
Exactly. This became an urgent imperative, a fact entirely blocked out of corporate media reports, when the Iraqi government put a run on the US dollar by converting its oil revenues into euros. When you look at those facts, this is not a psychological issue of projecting internal anxieties. It is a highly rational, brutally calculated economic takeover. The deletion of the UN report pages wasn't an act of psychological avoidance. It was a pragmatic, calculated cover-up to protect defense contractors.
I think that is where the true tension in this material really lies. The economic and strategic facts you're citing are irrefutable within the context of this history. The shift to the euro, the vast oil reserves, the dismantling of the civil commons, these are material realities. Yet, I maintain that McMurtry provides a vital, albeit chilling, framework for understanding how immense military power insulates itself from domestic and international critique.
Because the material motives are too ugly to present to a democratic public.
Exactly. The sheer scale of the violence requires an equally massive psychological apparatus to rationalize it. We are talking about 500,000 children dead as a consequence of the 1991 war and subsequent sanctions. We are talking about the deliberate bombing of civilian electricity and water treatment facilities and the use of nuclear waste and shells. You cannot sustain that level of systematic violence based purely on a spreadsheet about oil and euros. The public simply won't accept it.
So the group mind is the mechanism of translation.
Yes. It shows us that through moral absolutes, historical myth-making, and a fundamentalist group mind, the state is able to rebrand absolute war crimes, the supreme international crime of aggression, as acts of liberation. It highlights how the formula repeats time and time again. You blame terrorists, declare an imminent threat, denounce resistance as unpatriotic, and attack with total weaponry. Without the psychological framework of the group mind, the eager complicity of the media and the political class remains deeply inexplicable. They weren't all in on the oil profits. They were captured by the ideology.
And while I find that psychological analysis deeply fascinating, and I agree it explains the mechanism of public consent, I summarize my position by stating that the true strength of this material is its factual documentation of international law violations and resource motives.
The material base of the conflict.
Right. The destruction of the civil commons, the bypassing of the UN Charter, and the economic imperative of oil and the euro are irrefutable. However, attributing these deliberate actions to an inescapable cultural delusion underestimates the raw, calculated economic motives at play. The corporate war party knew exactly what it was doing. They weren't deluded, they were strategic. Furthermore, the documentation of massive human resistance, the millions marching, the overwhelming opposition in allied countries like Spain and Turkey, the ultimate refusal of the Security Council to authorize the war, proves that the mind of the global public was not imprisoned. The war occurred not because of an inevitable psychological destiny, but because a powerful military apparatus chose to bypass the democratic will and international law by sheer force.
It is clear that despite our differing interpretations of the ultimate drivers, whether they are fundamentally psychological and cultural, or strictly material and calculated, we both find a strong convergence on what is being exposed here.
We agree that this analysis masterfully highlights the severe contradictions between the stated humanitarian and legal goals of the U.S. invasion and the documented realities on the ground.
Absolutely.
The bypassed UN resolutions, the deleted evidence of military sales, the hypocrisy regarding Israel's violations, and the ultimate seizure of foreign publicly owned resources paint a stark, undeniable picture of imperial overreach.
Exactly. And I think that points to the immense value of critically examining the justifications provided by powerful nations for military actions. When a state claims to be acting on behalf of global security or freedom, examining the material outcomes is absolutely essential. We have to ask, who profits, who controls the resources, and who suffers the destruction of their civil commons? The historical precedents detailed in this material, from the 19th century annexations of Mexican territory and the Spanish-American War, right up to the modern era, warrant much deeper exploration. The blueprint of power often repeats itself, even if the pretexts change.
Indeed, there is so much more to explore in this material regarding how history, psychology, and economics intersect to drive state violence. The questions raised by McMurtry's analysis of the war state remain profoundly relevant today. Thank you for joining us for this debate, and we encourage you to continue questioning and exploring these perspectives on your own.